Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Anderson. I'm with the firm Sweetbaum Sands Anderson. My registration number is 14907. I represent the plaintiff appellant here, Mr. Dan Long. With me at council table today is co-counsel, Mr. David Patinos, and also in the courtroom is Mr. Long himself. Now, Mr. Dan Long is before the court today seeking its assistance in finalizing a settlement that he reached with the defendant Ditch Company quite a few years ago. In October 2010, the parties reached and documented an extensive and comprehensive settlement. Now, before the settlement could be concluded, the Ditch Company sought a judicial reformation of one of its terms. Other issues arose after that, and the parties have been trying to get those resolved with judicial assistance ever since that time. In fact, this is the second time this case has come to this court just on the settlement issue, and there was a prior appeal on some substantive issues. So the two main issues that Mr. Long has appealed here are the locked gate issue, as well as the legal description, and then also the attorney's fees issue. So I'd like to start with the locked gate issue first. Now, on this one, it's our position that the trial court used the wrong test to determine whether the lock gate was an unreasonable interference with Mr. Long's property. And, of course, this court reviews questions of whether the correct legal test was used on a de novo basis. Now, in the prior appeal on the settlement, this court required analysis under what we've called the Lazy Dog 1 case as well as the Lazy Dog 2 case. And if the court takes a look at the trial court's decision in this case, the one from September 2013, you'll see that the trial court really ignored Lazy Dog 2 and just followed Lazy Dog 1. And that's where we believe that the court made a mistake below. Now, in Lazy Dog 1, the Serbian estate holder there wanted to place gates across the easement. Serbian estate holder, of course, was the owner of the property. The easement holder was the dominant estate holder. They had the right to use this road. Serbian estate holder wanted to put up a gate. The gates would interfere with the dominant estate holder's use of the easement. Now here, it's the dominant estate holder that has placed the gate on the easement, and that interferes with Mr. Long's own property, not with use of an easement, but with use of his own property that he owns in fee. So therefore, the Lazy Dog 1 case, if it's taken verbatim, just really doesn't fit the facts of the case here. Now, there aren't any Colorado easement cases that outline fact-specific tests for analyzing whether something unreasonably interferes with property use like we have here. The cases are limited to easement use. And I think it's very important to keep in mind the difference here between interference with an easement and interference with a party's property that it owns in fee, which is what the case is.
Mr. Anderson, if I could back you up a second, how does the locked gate interfere with Mr. Long's access to his property?
He can't get to his own property with vehicular access because the locked gate keeps him out.
Well, my understanding, though, is that the part of his property that's beyond the gate is a very, very small area. Is that correct?
Well, it's, I think we had the measurements in there. It's 16 or 18 feet by about 6 or 8 feet. So that's about how big it is compared to the rest of his property. It's a small piece, yes.
So I didn't understand from the briefs any reason why Mr. Long might need vehicular access to such a small part of his property.
Well,
is there anything in the record that explains that?
Not specifically, no. Mr. Long didn't testify at the hearing, but it is his property, and there's nothing in any of the settlement documents that say that he should not have access to that piece of property.
Well, why isn't that a fact question? He had pedestrian access, which the trial court found. Why don't we have a fact question? The court said, I don't find this to be an unreasonable interference. I'm not seeing anything in the record. I'm speaking as if I were the trial court, not seeing anything in the record that required the man to get his car in this 6 by 10 foot spot, as if you could get it in there anyway. That would be clearly erroneous test, correct?
Right, but what we're arguing here, Your Honor, is that the judge analyzed these facts under the wrong legal test.
Okay, well, tell me how, I understand you've talked about there's a difference between easement rights versus the ownership rights. The court specifically cited both Lazy Dog 1 and Lazy Dog 2, the trial court, cited factors in Lazy Dog 1, said, I don't find any unreasonable interference with the man's rights as a grantor. How did the court not follow the remand order? That's exactly what the court was asked to do.
Well, because, Your Honor, because the trial court did not incorporate any of the factors of Lazy Dog 2 into its analysis.
Tell me which factors of Lazy Dog 2 would have made any difference.
Well,
I'm just pushing a little bit here. I don't mean to be rude. I of course, read both cases, and I'm not seeing how your suggestion here is they're inconsistent somehow. They seem pretty consistent to me. So push back. Tell me how Lazy Dog 2 sets forth a different standard than Lazy Dog 1. I guess I'm not seeing it.
Well, for instance, under Lazy Dog 2, the court should have analyzed the location of the properties involved, the location of the gate, the purpose of the easement, the road, and the gate before and after the settlement, the use of the easement, road, and gate before and after the settlement, the impact of the lock gate on trespassers, for example, Mr. Long's ability to access his new property with and without a gate.
So let me back up for a second, and I appreciate your answering the question. Lazy Dog 2 cites all these, I think it calls it circumstances, and cites the restatement. The Supreme Court in Lazy Dog 2 then says something to the effect of, these are relevant considerations designed to implement the primary purpose of effectuating the true intentions of the parties. So here, it seems that the court did assess, and I want you to push back. I'm just playing devil's advocate some with you. Seems like the court did assess the true intention of the parties, talked about this lock gate's been locked forever, the man never had a key, talked about the intent. So why does the court need to go through every relevant one of these circumstances when the whole point of these circumstances is to decide the intent of the parties?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you brought up the issue about how the lock gate had been locked historically. The thing to keep in mind about this settlement is that new boundaries were being drawn, new easements were being granted back and forth. And so, therefore, the history of the lock gate really didn't have any impact on what the intent of the parties was in this particular case. I think another important thing to keep in mind is the change from the restatement first, which is what Lazy Dog 1 was decided under, to the restatement third, which came out in 1999 or 2000. I think the Lazy Dog 2 case was decided in 1999, and the Supreme Court was working on a tentative draft, and I think the final draft was officially published in 2000. But there's some interesting language in the introductory note to section 4.1 of the restatement third, which talks about how the restatement third was making a change in looking at the use of real properties, in particular analyzing servitudes. The introductory note in section 4.1 talks about how the restatement first took a very strong line of free use of property, whereas the restatement third went more towards an intensive investigation of the intent of the parties, like Your Honor acknowledged, as well as being more likely to find servitudes than maybe the prior restatement was. So it's a little bit of a change of attitude there in the basis of the law between Lazy Dog 1 and Lazy Dog 2.
So, Mr. Anderson, what wasn't clear to me from your brief was how the factors from Lazy Dog 2 would actually apply in this case based upon the evidence in the record that might have dictated a different result. Can you explain that? I know you listed all these factors from Lazy Dog 2, but those factors in and of itself weren't really explained in terms of how they would apply here.
Well, I think for one thing, the court's analysis was pretty much centered exclusively on what the ditch company's view was of the situation, why they wanted a lock gate. But there really wasn't any analysis of the from the point of view of Mr. Long, Okay, what kind of burden is the lot gate going to put on him and his use of that real estate? What sort of long-term burden is going to occur here to Mr. Long's property? Because keep in mind, these are easements that are perpetual.
Right, but I asked you a few minutes ago about what use Mr. Long might make of his own property on the other side of the gate, and you said, well, he didn't testify at the hearing, so there's really no evidence about what use he would have made of the gate. So how does his own interest apply in this situation?
Well, I think that as a property owner, the court can certainly consider the use of property and the free use of property, as well as what the documents, the settlement documents themselves had to say, which was they were silent on the question of the lock gate, and that there was no exclusivity involved, and that sort of thing.
Well, I guess my question is similar to what Judge Talman just asked. The court looked at the location and limited size of the area in question, and in the absence of some testimony by Mr. Long to try to identify how he wished to use that small piece of land, what is the court supposed to base its conclusion on, other than the location and limited size? I mean, that's what the court had before it.
Well, the idea of the use of real estate, that an owner of real estate has the right to use the real estate, and the documentation that the parties negotiated extensively and came up with a long set of documents. I'd like to move on to another issue, unless there are any other questions here. I think that the legal description issue is an important one, and I think the thing to keep in mind here is the fact that this legal description that Mr. Long says that the ditch company should have prepared for its own property was actually doing double duty. Now, the easement description shows up in the easement agreement that says that the easement is going to provide access to the ditch company property, and here's a description of the ditch company property. But the property boundaries were changing. That was part of this overall settlement that was being put together. There's a boundary agreement that's part of it. There was a fence that was off of the property line issue, and the parties agreed that the fence line was going to be the property line rather than the surveyed boundary line because it had been there for a long time. So the parties needed new legal descriptions, both for Mr. Long's property, which we got, and for the ditch company property as well, so that the ditch company would have a comprehensive legal description of its property so that there wouldn't be any more problems in the future. And I think that the trial court looked at it exclusively as an issue about, oh, well, you're just describing the property where this road goes to. That was only half of it. The other half is to make sure that the ditch company had a proper legal description.
But Mr. Anderson, if I may interrupt you, the settlement agreement said for the property to be described as more particularly described. It didn't specifically say that there had to be a legal description. And I have to infer that there must have been some reason why that phrase of having a legal description wasn't included in the settlement agreement.
Because it's our view that the phrase more particularly described is the same thing as referring to a legal description.
But the problem is you have two experts who are extremely well respected in this community, from one from each side, who said it doesn't mean that. It can mean less than an actual legal description. Both of the experts said that, and the court relied on that.
Oh, I think Mr. Carpenter said that it called for a legal description. Also, if you look at the context, I think you need to look at more than just those particular words. If you look at the recitals where this appears, recital A talks about Mr. Long's property, and his property is going to be more specifically described. And that was a survey that we got as well. But the other thing is, what's the alternative? And the ditch company hasn't come up with a good alternative. The assessor number parcels didn't make any sense. That's why this court reversed the first time around. The prior legal descriptions that were in existence are incorrect because the boundaries changed. And the prior vesting deeds had the same problems. The only other thing they came up with was maybe a partial description of just a line between the two properties, but that doesn't make any sense in terms of showing where the easement is going to provide access to. The easement doesn't provide access to a line, it provides access to an entire park. So when you look at the alternative, okay, if it's not a legal description, what is it? Then you can see that none of the other ones make any sense, and so by process of elimination, it has to be a legal description.
I know your time's up, Mr. Anderson. I have one question I haven't had a chance to ask you, and I'm going to butcher his name. Is it Van Toyn? Is that the
Van Toyn?
Van Toyn, okay. The court on this issue, legal description issue, also relied on Mr. Van Toyn Jr.'s testimony about the ditch company never intended to pay for a survey, et cetera. And I know you have made an objection in your briefs about that, that it was extrinsic evidence of intent. Did you ever make that objection in the trial court?
Absolutely.
Okay, can you help me find it? Because I didn't see it. What's that?
During the hearing. I believe. I did, and if you'd like a citation to that, I'd be happy to provide it later today.
I'll find it, but I looked and I didn't see it, but I'll look again. Thank you.
Well, I thought I did, but it was a couple of years ago.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Ronald Young on behalf of the ditch companies. They have merged, and so I'll simply refer to them as the ditch companies, also Mr. Van Toyn Sr. and Mr. Van Toyn Jr. First of all, I would like to point out that in talking about this gate issue, that Mr. Long himself is a member of the class that's been characterized as the grantors. He is an owner of the Servient estate. These cases that we're looking at, Lazy Dog 1 and Lazy Dog 2, for instance, Lazy Dog 2 is a case that is on point about an expansion of the use of an easement. That's not what we have here, because we don't have any use of the easement yet. The closing hasn't happened. So to argue that these factors in Lazy Dog 2 are relevant or should be looked at in more detail, it really makes no sense here. There was a grant. There's no dispute that at the time of the grant, the gate was there, it had been there for 50 years. This court has already affirmed that Mr. Long, as a grantee, relinquished rights to object to the gate. There's a provision that's cited in the briefs in the agreement that actually says that there's an improvement in the easement that currently exists do not constitute an unreasonable interference. In fact, Mr. Patinos, who is the only fact witness that testified for Long's behalf at the hearing, including his surveyor, which when I get to my other issues on the extension of the 83 feet is somewhat suspicious to me. But Mr. Patinos, recognizing that this gate was an existing improvement, said in his testimony that talking about the changes in the language in paragraph 2B, that prompted a discussion about whether the gate that currently exists and Mr. Long's fence, which is an east-west fence, would constitute an immediate violation of the easement agreement. So we proposed adding language that we agreed on the third sentence, which says that the gate and Mr. Long's fence could stay because they were there and those didn't constitute an unreasonable interference. And that appears in the transcript, June 6th, at page 166, Your Honors. So what is important about that statement? And by the way, during the negotiation, there was no distinction made between grantor and grantee, and there was a good reason for that. A person who is granting, like Mr. Long did, an easement is basically saying at the time of the grant, the circumstances of the grant are not going to unreasonably interfere with my use as a grantor. And by the way, that's all we're looking at here today, is the use as a grantor, which at the most would be this section of property, this small section of property that you've pointed to. So it really makes no sense to say that Mr. Long is going to grant an easement that immediately interferes unreasonably in his right to use the property as the grantor. So in Lazy Dog 2, had this happened 5 years from now and the parties were using this easement and then decided to put a gate up, whether it be the servient owner or the easement holder, the dominant estate, then it would become an issue of whether, for instance, if it was the easement holder, whether the expansion of that restriction constitutes an unreasonable interference for the grantor. That's not what we have here. It's impossible to have that circumstance factually. You recognize that the court actually, in its order, went through the factors that it considered on the gate issue. And I would submit, as you point out, that Lazy Dog 1 and Lazy Dog 2 are not mutually exclusive. Those factors overlap. Lazy Dog 2 points to looking at the reasonable circumstances surrounding the property, the historical use. They do not reject looking at those factors. The court, in the court's order at page 345 in the court file record, describes the first factor, and it recognizes through testimony it was made to decrease hostilities between the parties. Second factor, the intent of the parties, that the evidence is clear that the defendant never intended for long to have access to the Panama Reservoir. That's going to be an important point when I get to the 83 feet extension argument. There's no dispute that Mr. Long does not have access to anything to the east of his property other than potentially this pedestrian access that extends 83 feet to the east on a road to nowhere for Mr. Long, because he can't get off the road from foot. That's the best case scenario if you buy Mr. Long's argument of the party's intent. The third factor the court points to, the nature and situation of the property, again, relying on Bantine Jr. for the evidence. Again, since Mr. Long chose not to testify, as you pointed out, we don't have any idea what he wanted to do with that piece of property. The court points that out in the order several times. There's no evidence that there could be an interference with the Servian estate. And I just submit, again, legally and factually, there couldn't be, because that grant waives the condition of unreasonable interference at the time of the grant. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been a grantor. I want to move, if I can, to the easement issue, 83-foot extension is what I like to call it. I'm sure the plaintiffs probably would prefer to call it something else.
Mr. Young, before you get there, can I just ask you one question about the legal description issue? I guess two questions. One, I asked Mr. Anderson whether he had objected to Mr. Van Tine's testimony about its extrinsic evidence of intent. Do you happen to recall if there was an objection?
I do. In fact, I can cite to the record as you were asking.
I guess the question is, was there or no?
There was an objection, and then it was resolved. The transcript, the page, so this would be the record on the transcript, June 19, page 305. There was an objection made. There was discussion had between counsel and the court.
What was the objection on extrinsic evidence of intent, specifically?
Correct. Yes. Okay. Yes. Ultimately, it was resolved that questions could be asked regarding the understanding of the parties. And then Mr. Van Tine was allowed, without objection, to testify to the following, and I quote, "Because of the safety of the recreation club, because of confrontations with some of its members in the past, and that's part of the reason why the North Road was built. And we wanted to give Mr. Long the privacy he wanted, but we also wanted to keep our access closed. This pertains to the gate. It also pertains to going 83 feet beyond the gate." And again, that's at page 305. So that was all testimony from Mr. Van Tine without objection.
I'm sorry, I'm asking, though, about the legal description. The question, he said, we never intended to pay for a survey and a legal description. It was too expensive. That was the testimony. I was trying to figure out whether there was an objection, because in the briefs, the objection is that was improper extrinsic evidence of intent. And I don't recall seeing an objection to that question, but I could be wrong. And if you don't know, I don't want to take your time now. I could certainly look again.
Well, I think I have that in my notes, Your Honor. Okay, so on the legal description, there was testimony by Mr. Van Tine that the ditch company had never wanted to pay for that survey. I think that was without objection.
Okay, and that's what I was trying to ask. All right, the other issue I had on this, and I really want to hear what you want to say about the easement extension. The court entered this order that said on the description, essentially preventing Mr. Long from objecting to anything that any description your side may come up with, as long as it complied with the order. Did anybody ask for such an order?
No, Your Honor.
All right, and all right, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to ask a follow-up question. Is, do you think that there that part of the court's order is appropriate?
I think it is in context, Your Honor. I mean, if you look at it and take it out of context by itself, it seems like it might be overreaching. But if you look at in the context of the issue being what was the plaintiff wanting to accomplish, and that is a full-blown survey of a 400-acre lake, in essence, and the court saying that more particularly described means it needs to be more particularly described than what it is, which is the assessor's parcel numbers, and then beyond that, anything that we basically said in terms of a legal description or a description of address. And in fact, if you look at the expert testimony on that issue, they indicate that a lot of times or oftentimes the beneficiary property at the end of an easement isn't described at all. Sometimes it's by address, sometimes it's just by the property owned by a certain person. So I think if you look at it in the context, I don't believe the judge meant to overreach. They meant to say, and I'm tired of hearing about this case since 2006, whatever the defendant's supply should suffice.
So just one more question on that point. So if Mr. Long were dissatisfied with what the ditch companies do in order to implement this provision, would he be able to file an objection and perhaps an appeal?
Probably, Your Honor. I mean, I think that there are two legal descriptions. One of them was actually suggested and provided by the plaintiff during this case, and there's a deed of trust that was utilized this legal description. I think that'll be fine. The argument that started this whole legal description was that the plaintiff was worried that somehow the ditch company could encumber his property after the settlement agreement unless this lake was surveyed accurately. That is absolutely not a possibility. The boundary agreement addresses that. There's been a completely new survey of Mr. Long's property. The parties agreed pursuant to statute to recognize that boundary. So there's no way that some sale of the ditch of the Panama Reservoir down the road is going to somehow encumber Mr. Long's property. That argument was a red herring. Unless you have questions on the gate, I'll move to our cross appeal. In essence, the court was tasked to determine the intent of the parties with respect to this 83-foot extension. The trial court actually found in its order that the board, so the ditch company, had made it clear it wanted the easement to end at the end of Long's property, and then went through photos to illustrate the area in question. Mr. Vantine was permitted to explain the quote that I just mentioned that talked about the safety issues, talked about the reasons why he didn't want Mr. Long to have access beyond the gate, certainly not beyond his property.
Let me interrupt you, because sure. I'm kind of cutting to the chase here. There's no question that evidence was in the record, but the court, I think, went a different direction, and I want you to correct me if I have these facts wrong. It sounds to me like you all sent an easement agreement that said it ends at his eastern boundary. He then struck it in red line, and you all accepted that change and sent it along. He then signed it. The court said, that sounds like pretty good evidence of that. It's evidence that goes the other way. You disagree, I know, but it's evidence that goes the other way. Then the court looked at this issue about the surveyor. Said Mr. Griggs, Mr. Long comes and says, Mr. Griggs made a mistake. And you all then agree to have Mr. Wright do another survey. Mr. Wright does it, he gives his information, Griggs does another plat, and you're all going along, and then your clients took the position, which is where the court said, kind of changed its mind. It's where the court comes at it. I know you strongly disagree with those facts, but why don't those facts support the court's ruling? Why isn't this a factual question?
Why isn't it? Well, it's Because there's basically one instance where Ms. McDonald, after a telephone conversation with Mr. Patinos, and they were talking about this easement that we hadn't, nobody had really considered this during the negotiation. This is an easement that's going to be between Mr. Bantine Sr. that owns the property on the north and the ditch company that owns the property on the south that this road traverses. Mr. Long really has nothing to do with that. So the concern was raised that we want the public, and by the way, the argument that the gates changed in terms of the west gate being the cutoff, the public can still access the reservoir by going on the north road, the bypass that the defendants constructed for Mr. Long's benefit, and all the way to the east gate, so that the east gate is really the only restriction for the public to get to the reservoir, which has all kinds of safety consequences and trespassing consequences. So to get to your question, so when we were talking about this easement, and this was in flux, this was post-settlement execution, initially Ms. McDonald thought, well, yeah, maybe it makes sense. And then she talked to me on March 10th, and Exhibit K, which is in the record at page 170, I actually raised this on March 10th for the first time. So it's not like we were changing our position, to use your words. I say, you know, it makes sense. We need this easement because in the future, the ditch company needs to be able to use Bantine Senior's property to get out and to get people in. I noticed that I'm out of time.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Young. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. We appreciate your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the oral argument.